I'm increasing the basic and new state pension by 4.8%, an increase of £440 per year for the basic state pension and an increase of £575 per year for the new state pension, in line with our commitment to the triple lock. Good news in her budget from the Chancellor for pensioners. But is it good news for the young? A constant background to spending and economic decisions for well over a decade now has been an argument about generational injustice, that the young are getting poorer. And that argument continues to grow. So, what are the facts here? Are we robbing young Peter to pay old Pauline? And if so, what should we do about it? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's look at how the generations from the baby boomers onwards have fared economically. I'm joined by Sophie Hale, who's principal economist at the Resolution Foundation think tank. Sophie, can we start by you reminding us exactly who the baby boomers are, and then tell us about how things were for them when they were young workers?
Yeah, so the baby boomers are the kind of post-war generation that were born between sort of the mid-1940s and the mid-1960s. They were a generation that entered the workforce and sort of progressed their careers during a period of very fast income growth in the UK. And so they saw really high rates of income progress. They earned a lot more than their parents did, and they saw year-on-year kind of income progress. They were also entering retirement age at the kind of post-global financial crisis period, which was a time when interest rates became really low and we saw a lot of wealth gains in the UK.
Wealth as opposed to income.
Yes, wealth, exactly. And this was a time when they were very wealthy. They were close to retirement. That's when you have the highest levels of wealth. And they were gaining huge amounts of what we call kind of passive wealth accumulation. So they weren't actively saving, but they were gaining from asset price inflation during that period.
And by asset price inflation, what we were talking about largely was housing, because also they were a generation that were gaining significantly by what was happening in the housing market. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. So house prices had increased a lot since they were buying houses. They also had these big pensions. They had defined benefit pensions at a much higher rate than kind of younger generations. They sort of fell out of favour. They became quite unaffordable, but they were a lot more generous than the kind of defined contribution pension schemes that most people have today.
And one of the things that occurs to me is that this generation is also the generation that benefited from the sale of council houses.
Absolutely. I mean, they were basically the beneficiaries of a number of very favourable policies to this generation. So, as you say, the right to buy policy that allowed them to buy council houses really helped boost home ownership rates amongst that generation. But there were other policies as well. So those that were lucky enough to go to university, it was a lot less than go in kind of younger generations, but they had those fees paid for.
Who comes after the baby boomer generation and what happened to them?
Yeah, so the next generation is the generation we call Generation X. Gen X were born from sort of the mid-60s to the start of the 1980s. They were basically starting their careers during that period of income growth that the baby boomers were benefiting from for most of their careers. Then the global financial crisis came along, and post that crisis, income growth in the UK has really kind of stalled and stagnated. And so for much of their kind of later career, they haven't been seeing this kind of year-on-year income progress. Home ownership rates had started to decline. House price to income ratio had started to increase. Houses were becoming less affordable.
You're coming off the defined benefits pensions. There are a few of those around. Were they actually going on pension schemes at all?
So some were, but there was no auto-enrolment that we have today. So for many of that generation, they wouldn't have necessarily been putting into a pension their entire kind of working lives. And so that does leave a group of that generation quite exposed.
So I think that pretty much takes us up to today's generation of 20 and 30-somethings. Which generation do we call that?
So that's the generation that we call the millennials, born over the 80s and the 90s, basically, all the way up to the millennium. This generation is one that has spent most of their working career post, you know, financial crisis, post this real slowdown in income growth, and they just haven't seen the generational income progress that the generations before saw. So if you were born in the early 80s, you're actually earning less than someone who was born 10 years earlier than you at that kind of age of 30. They're much more likely to have gone to university, which in many ways is really positive. On the other hand, it means they're very likely to be paying back quite expensive student loans.
And, of course, housing affordability.
Yes. So house price to income ratio has kind of ballooned in recent years. It's 8 times income almost in England. It's even higher, more than 10 times if you live in London. So what we've seen is home ownership rates really, really falling for this generation.
Now, take us to Gen Z, or what I think the Americans call Gen Z.
Yes. So Gen Z, the generation born since the start of the millennium, they are the latest generation. We're not seeing very much of the data on them yet. They're only just starting to enter the workforce and definitely not really in a large number looking at kind of buying houses yet, because it's just kind of too early in their working lives. What we do know is that youth home ownership rates are starting to pick up. So it's possible that as a generation, they do end up with slightly higher youth home ownership rates than the millennials that came before them.
Sophie, thank you. And please stay with us because we'll come back to you later. For the moment, I want to turn to Bobby Duffy, who's Professor of Public Policy at King's College London, where he conducts polling on social attitudes and values. Bobby Duffy, let's talk about perceptions. Are you seeing a divide between the current generation of young workers and today's pensioners when it comes to perceiving how well or badly younger people are doing economically?
Yeah, I think there is a general perception that things have got tougher for young people today. The public recognise that. And actually, one of the key themes of understanding generations is to understand that we're interconnected in those perceptions. So the fact that we think it's worse for young people isn't just a problem for young people themselves, it's a problem for all of us, because we want a better future for our children and grandchildren. And when people lose that sense that things are going to get better, it's not just an implication for those directly affected, it's about our faith in the system overall.
Oh, so do you mean that older people might very well look at younger people and think, well, I'm not doing so badly, but the young people clearly are, therefore the country's in decline?
Yeah, we are deeply connected up and down. We got very used to the idea post-war that each generation would progress, or at least wouldn't slip backwards, that they would do as well or better than we did in that kind of post-war period. And we know that. We can see that in the data. So if you go back to 2003, half of the public in the UK thought that things would be better for future generations of young people, and a quarter thought it was worse. And then every measure that we've had post-financial crisis, 2008, 2009, those figures have reversed. So only a quarter of people have thought it was going to be better and a half thought it was going to be worse for young people. And it's even nudging down each time we do this measure. So it's only like 1 in 5 people now who think the future is going to be better for young people. So we definitely have that sense of decline. And that does feed into a more general sense of things were better in the past, the future looks scary, and we need to try something different.
Through your research, what changes are you seeing in the way today's young workers, let's say those under 30, actually live their lives?
Younger people are going through a more delayed adulthood. So education is lasting longer. They're living at home longer, getting married later, having kids later. All of those types of things are happening. But I think what we also need to understand is this is not a kind of era of glorious exploration for young people just going slower. A lot of it is enforced because of the economics of this, that they can't afford to move out of their parents' home, can't afford to get married, can't afford to have kids. And that has all sorts of implications for not least birth rates and future of having a working age population that can support our aging population. So that is a real change. What is less of a real change is a cohort change. So something specific to this generation is this sense that we've got a feckless generation of young people who are not committed to work. That is not true. And we see that repeated throughout history, this sense that young people are the worst generation of young people that we've had come through, and specifically around work as well.
In other words, the current younger people, they can get it in the neck both ways, can't they?
There is a sense of this is down to their own behaviour. So the EasyJet, gym, Netflix lifestyle is what's stopping them owning their own home, rather than the huge increases in house prices, stagnating wages, tougher lending rules. When we poll people and ask them which of these is the correct explanation for why young people can't own their own home, over half the public go for the EasyJet, gym, Netflix lifestyle being the real cause. And the real tragedy in this is that young people themselves also tend to blame themselves. So nearly half of Gen Z, the under 30s, say that's true for them themselves. So we've got this double whammy for younger generations of really tougher context economically, but also a sense of it's their fault.
Can we talk about what divisions may exist within the age group itself?
I guess the big dynamic that has shifted now is it's also the case that not every baby boomer made it big, far from it. So we've had this enormous increase in private wealth, a concentration of that private wealth among one cohort in the boomers, but only within a section of that boomer generation. So the top third have the vast majority of that wealth. So what that means is that wealth is flowing down very unevenly to the generations that are following, where some are going to get an enormous amount and some are going to get very little or nothing. And that's through bank of mum and dad activities as well as inheritance. So what that means really is you've got a very fractured Generation Z under 30-year-old group where some are very well set up and are going to be even more set up when the inheritance flows down, while others are going to get nothing.
Can you pick up in your polling or your studies any kind of sense of resentment to those younger people who do have it all?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Now, you do see that. And that is a fracturing in society more generally, but particularly among young people. And it does help explain what we're seeing as a general trend across lots of the polling, which is more polarization within people's attitudes built on very different life experiences and life chances. So that sense of people ending up where they started rather than be able to make it in life because wealth is more important to our economic success than income these days is a key aspect in that sense of division across the country as a whole and including among young people.
Bobby Duffy, before we go on, a quick reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the one which looks at how the latest peace plan for Ukraine emerged and how likely Putin is to agree to end almost 4 years of war, and the one which explores what the US is doing off the coast of Venezuela. Now back to intergenerational economics. We're joined by Xiaowei Zhu, senior research economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Jane Falkingham, who's Professor of Demographics at Southampton University, and Sophie Hale from the Resolution Foundation, who's still with us. Shall we do, if you take the median incomes of 25 to 30-year-olds today, how would that person's income compare with their counterpart in the baby boomer generation, say 40 years ago?
The median disposable income after adjusting for inflation is quite a lot higher for young people today than for baby boomers when they were young, so about 40% higher than for those born in the 1960s and about 80% higher than those born in the 1950s. Now, that's not surprising, right? Because we're a much richer country now than we were back in the 70s and 80s. And throughout history, it's generally been the case that the living standards of one generation are better than the living standards of the generation that came before them. What is surprising is that this sense of generational progress has stalled. So we saw a big improvement between those born in the 60s and 70s, but then the cohorts born in the 1980s and afterwards don't seem to have much higher living standards than the cohorts before them. And also, baby boomers might have had lower incomes when they were young than today's young people, but their incomes grew over time and they're now enjoying higher incomes in retirement than they did in their working lives.
And what about as they look at their prospects going forward? I mean, they will themselves one day be pensioners. Some of them in the younger generations are about to become pensioners. So what about that?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people today might not expect to see the lifetime earnings growth that previous generations saw. And that's because we're in this long period of wage stagnation. They're not building up the same assets and they're getting onto the housing ladder much later than previous generations. And that's also why so many more people are relying on gifts from their parents and grandparents in order to buy a first home.
And what about the relative distribution of taxation between, say, income, which young people will be getting, and savings, which they're unlikely to have?
So in general, in this country, we tax wealth and returns from wealth much more lightly than we tax incomes from work. So, for example, we pay an employee national insurance contributions on earnings from work, but not on incomes from pensions and savings interest and rent. And it's older people who tend to have these non-labour sources of income. Also, the stock of wealth in this country has increased enormously from about 3% of GDP in the 1980s to more than 6% of GDP today. But the share of tax revenues we get from wealth taxes has stayed pretty much constant throughout that period.
So in other words, if you've already got wealth, you're doing well. But if you're reliant almost entirely upon your income, then in that case, you're doing less well. And that will be a generational difference.
Exactly. And it's also harder to build up wealth if your incomes aren't growing.
Let's come back now to the question of housing, Sophie. How much of that generational divide is actually simply down to the question of the capacity to own homes? I mean, just anecdotally, it's all I ever hear about from people who are, let's say, 20 or 30 years younger than me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really important measure of progress, and it's a consideration for how people feel about how well they're doing. So if you can get on the housing ladder, you have that kind of secure home, which you don't have in the private rented sector, and you have that ability to start accumulating wealth as well. And what we do see is that those who are able to become homeowners start to accumulate wealth a lot more quickly. So there is quite a big divide between those who can become homeowners and those who can't. As previously mentioned, there's a lot of inequality with who's able to now become homeowners that there didn't used to be. It used to be a lot more about your income, your earnings. And now it's increasingly about, well, how wealthy are your parents? Are your parents homeowners? Can they help you?
Let's just get a couple of stats into this if we can. What would home ownership have looked like for a baby boomer, say, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, compared with what it looks like for comparative ages now?
At the age of 30, if we look at the home ownership rates of the baby boomers that were born in the early 60s, half of them were homeowners at that age. And that compares to less than a third of millennials who were born in the early 80s.
Right. So it's gone down significantly. Let's go through the whys now. I would argue, well, in my day, yes, but we have much higher interest rates. You could get much less of a multiple of your wages as a mortgage because mortgage companies were much tighter. So why is it so much worse now?
Yeah, I mean, paying higher interest rates definitely is a factor. Generally, the millennials have been fairly lucky in facing quite low interest rates, but it doesn't offset the much higher house prices. So just to get a deposit, you know, a 5%, 10% deposit to put towards your house is incredibly difficult given how high house prices have gone relative to their earnings. So it takes a lot more years of saving at a kind of reasonable level before you'll have that amount that you can then get on the housing ladder. And yes, then your kind of interest payments will be lower, but paying off the house is going to take just as long, or if not longer, just because of the value has increased by so much. So we've seen longer mortgage terms as well for younger people today.
Right. And as you speak, I can already think of how that might have an impact within a generation. But Jane, before we do that, let's look at the consequences of those shifts for millennials in terms of what they can do and what they think they can do with their lives.
So Sophie has already been talking about housing creating a sense of security. And of course, people's decisions around having children relate to the sense of security they have, not just in terms of whether they're in work, but also the home life that they can provide for children. So again, picking up on that age 30 comparison, a woman born in 1946 had, on average, had 1.7 children by the time she hit age 30. A woman born in 1964, so at the end of the baby boom, she'd had, on average, 1.2 children. But a millennial woman born in 1994 had had, on average, just 0.76 children. So over halving the number of children you've had by age 30. And this trend to fewer later births is resulting in smaller families.
Might we expect a catch-up effect later on?
Well, we do expect some catch-up effect, but there's only so much you can postpone having children. There's some very interesting differences, actually, between the start and the end of the baby boom. So the women born in 1946, 9% were childless. But the women born in 1964, which is the end of the baby boom, 20%. Are childless. And I think this is something that perhaps not very many people recognise. We've seen a rise in childlessness. Now, hopefully that postponing of having children, maybe with IVF, people will be able to realise their intentions, but not everybody will be able to.
Right. And is there any sense that what becomes ingrained there is, if you like, a kind of a set of cultural preferences that didn't exist before, which may have started in economic circumstances, but end up just being in the way in which people think about their lives?
We're seeing an increase in people saying, well, actually, I'm choosing not to have children for my contribution to climate change or for other reasons. I think also, though, we are seeing more women in the workforce and women saying, well, actually, I don't know if I can combine work and family life.
Can we go back to pensions for a moment? Shall we? How do changes in pension income compare with changes in earned income?
So average pensioner incomes are now similar to average incomes for working age people once housing costs are taken into account, and they're now higher than incomes for families with children. That looks very different from two decades ago, where if you look back to the early 2000s, average pensioner incomes were 25% lower than incomes for working age families. Pensioners now are less likely to be in poverty than working age people, which is really quite striking.
Sorry, let me get that absolutely straight. A pensioner is less likely to be living in poverty than a working age family is.
Pensioners are now less likely to be in poverty than working age people.
Yes. I think we've got to mark this because this is a total reversal of where things were when I was young, where pensioner poverty was the thing that you were concerned about. And I think a lot of people may have some difficulty in reorienting themselves around the facts that you're just giving them. But anyway, carry on.
That's absolutely true. So if you look back to the late 90s, nearly 30% of pensioners were in poverty. So almost one in three pensioners. That's come down tremendously, so that now only 16% of pensioners, roughly one in six, are in relative poverty, compared to 20% of working age adults.
Now, Sophie, what politicians will say is, well, yeah, that's a great achievement, actually. And the achievement is down to things like the triple lock mechanism, which makes sure that pensioners can't lose out, given what's going on around them.
I guess there's two points to reflect on that. One, child poverty is a lot higher and you know, we should be worried about that. And we are seeing the government starting to take some actions to target that. But secondly, the policies like the triple lock have been hugely effective at lowering pensioner poverty.
Just remind us what the triple lock actually is.
So the triple lock is a commitment by the government that the state pension will increase by the highest of the increase in earnings, inflation, or 2.5%. So basically, pensioners can never see the pension increasing by less than 2.5%. And what we've seen in recent history is that this has been a much more expensive policy than was expected. So the Office of Budget Responsibility, the OBR, have kind of looked at the growth in the state pension in recent years and basically shown that it's just having this much larger ratcheted effect than we expected. So the state pension has increased by 60% between 2010 and 2023, which is much faster than the average earnings growth that we've seen over the same period, which was around 46%. And in fact, it was double the rate of increase that we've seen for working age benefits.
Jane, given what we just heard, that means if you have an increasing number of pensioners relative to people who are income earners in your economy, that's pretty serious.
Absolutely. So the age structure of the UK population is changing. It's been changing actually over the last 100 years, but it's going to increase in pace as the baby boom generation moves into retirement. So currently around one in five of the population is aged over 65, but this is going to go up considerably over the next 10 to 15 years as that bulge moves into retirement. So there's going to be fewer workers to pay for more pensioners.
Is the perception right that actually pensioners just vote more than everybody else and therefore you can't afford to take stuff away from them because they'll vote you out?
Well, they do vote more than other age groups, that's true. Whether they'll vote you out or not in terms of taking things away from them, I think is an open question. But we have seen a big pushback on winter fuel payments. If you think one in five of the population is aged over 65, that means around a third of the electorate is aged over 65. So they're a big voting bloc, but they don't always vote on an age-based basis. In fact, there's some very interesting work done by colleagues at Oxford, and indeed with Sophie's colleagues at the Resolution Foundation, on people's willingness to vote for different types of policies. And older people actually want to vote for policies that improve the lives of young people, as well as policies that improve their own lives.
Let's talk, Jane, now about solutions. Are there any kind of levers that we can pull?
There are a number of policy levers we can pull, and indeed we're already pulling them. So the UK is actually in advance of other European countries in terms of revisiting our pension age. In France, they're still having national strikes around raising the state retirement age, whereas we're already pushing up to 67, and I know there are more changes in the offing. The other things we need to do is to actually think about retaining people in the workforce for longer. And we're starting to do that. So around 15% of men and 9% of women aged over 65 are still actually working. But we've got to think about making sure we put support mechanisms in place that allow people to keep working and to keep contributing.
Sophie, now to you. What kind of solutions do you think we should look at? What about the triple lock?
Yeah, so they definitely need to take a serious look at the triple lock. And this is about looking at what is the end point that we want to get to with the triple lock. It's not about, you know, cutting the money that's going to pensioners from where we are now. But if nothing is done and, you know, there is just no political consensus to kind of get a grip on the state pension at the moment, it is going to keep escalating and become increasingly unaffordable for the UK.
And is there anything we can do to boost the actual wealth of younger people?
Yes. Yeah, so at the Resolution Foundation, we proposed effectively a citizen's inheritance. It would be an amount of money that you get when you're young, which can be put towards very specific defined uses. So it can be put towards your education. It can be put towards getting on the housing ladder. It can be put towards a pension, you know, purposes that can really kind of help you to kind of get started in life or to raise your income later in life and accumulate wealth. And so ultimately how this would be paid, it would be paid by looking at how well have different generations done from the government and from kind of society, and it would fund a kind of one-off payment of £10,000 for young people so that they can use it for these things.
And Xiaowei, you now get to wave your magic wand.
I think a key thing the government could do is try to make housing more affordable for young people, so to make it easier for them to get on the housing ladder and to try to bring rents down. Part of that is about encouraging house building, and this current government's planning reforms are already a step in the right direction. But there's also more we could do to fix taxation on housing. So, for example, stamp duty discourages people from moving homes, which stops older people from downsizing when their kids leave home. And also, because our council tax system is regressive by design and is subject to a single person discount, this means that older people living in expensive properties have less incentive to downsize and free up the housing stock than if we had a more proportional system. In the end, though, I think the best thing the government can do to help younger people is to get growth going again, right? Because it's only when the economy grows that people's earnings improve and they're able to set aside savings. And if we had more growth, the government wouldn't have to keep raising taxes just to keep up with spending needs.
Well, that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Xiaowei Xu, Jane Falkingham, Sophie Hale and Bobby Duffy. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Cordelia Hemming and Kirsteen Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was James Beard and the editor was Richard Barden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Shari Vahl, and I've been investigating fraud for decades. Now I'm shining light on the secret techniques criminals use to steal your money. With insight from guest experts and the real people involved in these scams, so you can see the fraudsters coming before it's too late. That's the new series of Scam Secrets. Listen now on BBC Sounds.